Thanks for tuning in and listening to Riley on Film. I am Damian Riley, your ghost host. While you're here, I hope you got your horror's worth. Find out more and subscribe, only not in that order, at RileyOnFilm.com. Now, enjoy the show. Here we are. I have an amazing friend from high school and life. We've kept in touch since high school, and he's been on before. David Cuff, how are you today, David?
Hey, Damian, I'm fine. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome.
I love talking about movies.
Yeah. David and I used to ride scooters to high school. He still rides them.
Yeah.
What are you riding these days?
I have a, right now, the main thing I'm riding is a 1966 Vespa Super Sport. And it's funny because that was the one that I always wanted when we were in high school. I used to go to the library, and they had a book on British invasion bands. Peter Quaife, who was the bassist for the Kinks, had one. And
no way.
There was a picture of him on it. And I was like, oh, that thing looks really cool, because it was unlike other Vespas. It didn't have a round headlight. It had a trapezoid-shaped headlight. And I was like, oh, that thing looks really cool. And then in 2001, I bought the one I have off a guy in Pennsylvania and had it shipped out by Forward Air. And then I rode it around like in its beat-up form for a real long time. And then I took a really long time to restore it, like something like 6 years, because it was when my kids were small. And so it took forever to restore it. And then
you are really good at restoring things.
I don't know about that, but this one was a labor of love.
I remember it was, what was it? Like five, could be 10 years ago. I don't even know anymore. Life's going so fast by my ears, but it was something like, Fix the Girls' Bikes Up weekend or something. Remember that?
A couple Schwinn Stardusts for Madeline and Amelia for their birthday. Or no, not their birthday, for Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah, and it's always great to catch up with you, David. You're doing so many amazing things. You are a publisher, which we talked about, and, I should dig out that other episode and put it right before this, so I don't have to go through it all again. But I am so enamored of you. You are an amazing guy.
And likewise.
Thank you, man. Yeah. We used to have fun just riding our scooters. Just real quick on the situation with my scooter, because most of my friends don't even know that I used to ride a scooter. But my good friend Kevin Petrisco at the time, I think it was probably 16, 17, he got himself the little red Riva. Remember those Rivas?
Oh, yeah.
And, 1980s. And maybe at the end of the episode when we talk about Repo Man, it'll bring back those times. Mopeds and such. Actually, mopeds were out by then. This was a Riva. This was almost like a little motorcycle. Looked like a little motorcycle. He got one. Of course, I pined to my father. Oh, I would love to have one. You're never, you guys don't love me. All that. So I whined about it, and his uncle had this yellow Bajaj Chetak, it was called, in his underneath his apple tree in his backyard in Anaheim. So my dad brought me out there, and he said that he would sell it to me, and so I mowed lawns and did various things around the house, I think you could ride him at 15, couldn't you? I think you were allowed to ride them.
I don't know. I waited till 16 because I got.
Oh, okay.
I know I got my driver's license to drive a car first, and was borrowing my parents' car while I was working at Handyman Hardware, saving up money to buy a Vespa. And then I got
Handyman.
Yeah, Handyman over in Saddleback Lanes, the bowling alley.
Oh, right. Yeah. Boy, that little center over there changed so much through the years.
Still there, and interestingly, I used to take my kids bowling there all the time.
I love that bowling alley. What about Skateway?
That's something else. I forget what it is.
Yeah, of course, Skateway couldn't have hung in there that long. No way, but...
You can always tell who lived in the area long enough if you just say Skateway, because that was like the hub for kids for so long. Like, before I moved, like going back into the 70s, Skateway was the place.
Oh my gosh, just all that down there.
Yeah.
What was the other? There was an arcade. You remember the arcade down there?
I sunk ridiculous amounts of money into that.
Me too. Yeah. We used to put quarters, my brother and I would put quarters in a sock and ride our bikes down there.
And Sandbar Pets is still around?
Wow. Now that is impressive. Does it look 70s or have they redone it? Because I remember it looked so 70s when you went in there.
Yeah, I can't recall. Yeah. I've just driven by it.
Yeah. A lot of Mission Viejo is wood. You know, it used to be wood. Instead of doing the plastic signs that are so popular nowadays. Mission Viejo took the time to pretty much make every store have a wood look to it. So, that was my childhood and yours too. So it's great to reconnect with you, buddy.
Yeah.
We can share much more, but I'll tell you one thing we share is the love of movies. And we come from the Blockbuster video generation. We used to, get those Blockbuster videos and put them on our baseboard, put our feet on them. Or I don't remember if I think in my seat I had something you could put them in. I don't quite remember that.
Remember, and interestingly, even before that, we were talking about that shopping center by where we grew up. And of course, there was that video rental place in there. And and Mark Ferrara worked in there for a real long time.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yes. Hello, Mark, if you happen to listen.
Yeah.
Been a long time, sir.
Yeah, no, he and I were just texting this morning.
Oh, that's so great. Is he into horror at all?
Mark? Yeah, he's still very much into horror movies.
Oh,
and
that great. Was, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that I was, remember seeing H.P. Lovecraft movies with him. Like, we would all go.
Yeah. And then he goes, there's a some sort of, he lives up in Burbank. There's some sort of really cool H.P. Lovecraft kind of, H.P. Lovecraft's Historical Society, and it's like a store as well. He's gone into that a few times and taken pictures for us and texted him back, and it's pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah, I need to reunite with him one day. Maybe I will.
Yeah.
Today, we are going to talk about two movies mostly, but then we're going to do a what you've been watching time at the end, which is really cool because those are sort of like more just your response to a movie. It's not like, okay, it was made in 2010. You don't have to really get into the details as much. I found it. It's more fun if we just, here's what I've been watching, and boom, just give your response. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So we are looking at some horror movies today. That won't surprise my usual fans because that's my deal. I like horror movies and the way they make you sort of look over your shoulder when you get home. You know, I remember I saw The Silence of the Lambs with Anthony Hopkins, who I love not only as an actor, but as a person. I love to watch interviews with that man because he's so strong and together. But I remember watching Silence of the Lambs and coming home and just being in the house. All my family was asleep. I was like 18 and walking around and just like every little sound made my neck just stand on end, you know. Those are the ones I like. I have a tiny little cough. If I do it, I'm going to hopefully edit it out for you good people. But, yeah, it's not COVID. I took a test. It's not COVID. Yeah. I'm glad of that. But anyway, here's the movies we're going to talk about. The theme of this show is horror noir, I'm calling it. I think that's pretty accurate, Dave. Do you like that title? Horror noir?
No, I think that's totally, I think at least on my side with Nightmare Alley, definitely that was horror noir. But it's not, I don't think it's the way people might think.
Right.
There's no monsters or anything like that. I mean, it's the human beings that are truly horrific.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that this morning. I was thinking, why did they call that horror? And we'll get into that. But the visuals of Frankenstein come to mind when Rooney Mara puts her hands on the Nightmare Alley set, you know, and it puts the electricity through her.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't really call that horror, but it's just things that are sort of shocking or...
Yeah.
Horror is a lot of times things that are sort of repulsive. And you might say, you know, well, why do you want to watch movies that are repulsive? It's almost like cathartic in a way. It can be. And so, you know, the gorier the better for some people. Other people just like the moodiness of horror. I'm a little of both. I like the way that H.P. Lovecraft movies are, the gore. And then I also like the way when you walk away from some of these movies, especially these two, these noir films, you just sort of carry it with you in your head. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I mean, boy, in Sin City, you know, you've got the guy's son. You know, and then you've got the, you know, who's the, you know, the politician's son, who's like a child molester, murderer, or whatever. I think his character's called the Yellow Bastard or whatever. And then, the serial killer as well. The guy who has the sharpened nails.
Was that Benicio del Toro? Or was that, you're talking about a different.
No, I'm talking about Sin City.
But Benicio del Toro is the guy at the beginning when he goes in and Brittany Murphy's like his ex or something.
Oh, yeah.
Is that the serial killer?
No, the serial killer I'm thinking of is the guy who had the women's heads on the wall.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like that. This movie is all over the place.
Yeah.
You have to kind of almost take notes to really get what's going on. Or you could just sit back and just let it wash over you. That's what I did. And it's the visuals are, they're literally relaxing visuals. You can watch this movie and like literally relax, have it be like a relaxing activity.
Yeah.
It really draws you in. So the two movies we're going to do are Nightmare Alley. I'm glad you brought up Sin City. That's our second one. And then at the end, we'll do what we've been watching. We got some exciting surprises there. We're going to take a look at Repo Man. Take a look at Doom. But those will be kind of a little terse. We're just going to hit those and then we'll move on. Okay? So,
good.
Here we go. Let's see. I want to start with, you know what? It's yours, David. Would you want me to start or do you want to start?
What, with Nightmare Alley?
Yeah.
So, Nightmare Alley is, you know, Guillermo del Toro's 2021 adaptation of a 1947 movie, which I think was based on a novel, but don't hold me to it. But it's definitely a noir film, but I think it kind of fits into this genre of horror noir because everybody in it, or at least the central characters, most of the central characters are awful. And a lot of it takes place in a carnival, in the sideshow of a carnival, which is obviously kind of a horrific setting. You know, you've got various kind of freaks and stuff like that. But the main horror of it is the geek show. And of course, geeks back then are, you know, crazy people who eat live animals, right? They like they them and kill them. That was like that was the original term for a geek, right? And so the horror of that is how they turn a person into a geek. And you know, and keep them doing it because it's pretty awful. And there's only so much I want to give away because I don't know if we do this.
Yeah, you know what? It's up to you.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, and I can.
Yeah, that's great. Let's take that approach.
Yeah, I can talk around it, but you know, let's put it this way. I think it's safe to say that most people out in the audience would realize that sideshows, you know, carnival sideshows of that era were not squeaky clean environments, and that most of the people there were not ethically or morally upright. And and so a lot of shady stuff happens in this sideshow. And it's about this main character, a drifter, Stan Carlisle, who gets involved in this thing. But Stan is quite the anti-hero, and he starts intuiting, and I'm not giving anything away, he starts intuiting other people's acts and kind of figuring out how they do other people's acts. And he learns from other people. And basically, when he learns enough, he becomes a really helpful person in the carnival sideshow. But yeah, when he learns enough from everybody, he's basically ripped off their axe and decides to go on the road with this girl that he and she have fallen in love with. Perhaps what happens is a series of events that just show this guy's complete moral decline. And he really is a horrible person. He is a living horror. And most of the people he deals with are living horrors.
And, are you talking about Bradley Cooper's character?
Yeah, or Kate Blanchett.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. She's
frightening, truly frightening. And I don't think that's giving anything away, because I mean if you look at Lord of the Rings, you know, when she's got that really scary looking face and like, she's just a very intense woman, and she's hot too. I mean, Kate Blanchett. I don't think people talk enough about Kate Blanchett. I think she's a great actor.
Kate Blanchett's a wonderful actor. And she does an amazing job in this, and Bradley Cooper does an amazing job as Stan. And there's so many. Willem Dafoe does a great job. There's so many. Ron Perlman's great in it. It's got this blockbuster cast.
Yeah.
And it was a total sleeper. I don't know if anybody recalls, but like, Martin Scorsese like practically campaigned for this movie, and Scorsese had nothing to do with it. He thought it was such an amazing movie, and he was like horrified. There's that word again, but he was horrified that it did so poorly. And so he was like literally campaigning to get people to watch it. And I mean, it was a total box office flop. I checked out the Wikipedia on it last night, and it cost like something like $60-70 million to make, and it didn't even make 40 at the box office,
you know.
And now it's streaming.
Wow. I mean when I think of the sets alone, I mean, so much
went
into this. I forgot to mention Guillermo del Toro, who did Pan's Labyrinth and Blade 2 and many amazing visual horror films and action films. Oh my gosh, he's done so many movies. I've done entire shows on him, but he's just somebody I really look up to. And earlier when I was saying, you know, like, I like it where it kind of stays with me, stays in my head, you know, like the darkness of certain movies, that's what he brings to this. Because when you go and you look at the you mentioned geeks, the sideshow freaks, you know, and they show them in the bottles, and it's got the fetus in there and stuff. Now, listen, I'm going to probably save some spoilers, so I'm going to take this off Dave's plate. There are going to be spoilers for the rest of the show. So if you haven't seen these two films, we're going to try real hard to be respectful to the plot and not reveal too much. But I just want to let you know that if that's going to bother you, then you might want to stop now.
Well, and I think that Nightmare Alley was a sleeper in the same way The Crying Game was a sleeper. Remember?
Oh, how could you forget?
And then, I mean, that was an amazing movie. That was an amazing movie.
Yes, it was.
And Nightmare Alley is a total sleeper. It's such a bummer that it hasn't gotten the attention that it really deserves, because it's quite a movie. It's really good. And so, yeah, if you haven't seen it, I would just stop listening to me and I would go over to HBO Max and queue it up.
Yeah. And then come back and play yeah. again.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people haven't seen it. You're right. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. It's a terrific movie. And it's got this amazing cast. The story is insane.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's such a roller coaster. The directing, it's Guillermo del Toro, and it's every bit as amazing as he's able to muster. And it's also really fun because it's something atypical for him. You know,
yeah.
It's not a lot of action sequences. It's not a lot of creatures. Yeah. And it doesn't lean on a bunch of crazy visuals and stuff like that, like you're used to in movies like, say, Pan's Labyrinth. But yeah. At the same time, it's such a great.
I agree. I'm so glad you brought it up. I hadn't seen it when we were talking about doing the show. You said Nightmare Alley, and I was like, oh my gosh, I want to see that. But I was like those people that aren't making it a big movie. I was just like looking at it and going past it. But the thing is, well, Guillermo del Toro is. I think it's like getting somebody really cheap, you know, because he wrote it. And whenever he's in on something, you know, he's going to put little creatures in and stuff, you know, because that's just what he does. He just does that in everything. The Shape of Water, people might remember. I didn't really like that movie, but it did really well, you know, for him. And this one, I guess, didn't do it as well, but it just takes you to that creepiness. There you go. The creepiness factor. That's what I look for.
Ton of creepiness, and the tension is like steel braided cables at times. It's such a good movie, and it really is. There's people in it that are so horrible that it's a really neat blend of film noir and horror and.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just saying, you remember the guy Richard Jenkins, I think is his name? He thinks that the guy can summon this woman from the dead that I think he killed or something. I don't know if they really fleshed that out ever, but you know what I'm talking about? I'm going to get myself in a hole here now, but he's the guy in Eat, Pray, Love, and he's been in a few other things that are well known. But anyway, his name's Richard Jenkins, and he's the one that said that they give him the lie detector test. Remember that? They put the lie detector test. That guy. So he's pretty horrible. It's like you get this idea like he did something so horrible to this woman, you know, but you never find out why. And then he's like totally buying into Bradley Cooper's character, because he's almost like tying up loose ends of a murderer. That's what I thought about.
Well, I don't say too much because
it's a lot. Well, we already told them there were spoilers, so it's okay.
Yeah, but it's messed up. And of course the main character is awful. You know.
Yeah. Didn't they say at the beginning that Bradley Cooper was a serial killer? I mean. I say Bradley Cooper, his character, I should go with. But, I mean, wasn't he a serial killer? At the beginning, he's dragging a body. Remember that?
Well, okay, so if we're going to do spoilers, then... That's after he murdered his dad. I mean, that's the slow reveal.
Oh, the dad,
The whole movie, the slow reveal is that it... Because they keep showing these scenes of him with, like, his father and the house on fire. And then you finally are able to stitch together that he murdered his own father through hypothermia. He froze his dad to death, then buried him under the floorboards, and then set the house on fire and went on his way to join the carnival.
in the world.
Yeah, I think I kind of read that wrong because I looked at a summary and the summary said a serial killer or something, this and that and the other. So I assumed he was a serial killer, but I didn't see him killing anybody, you know, except that one scene. But what he did impress me was when he was getting his analysis done. Like when he was laying in the chair. And, well, it takes a long time. She's like, lay down in the chair. He's like, I don't want to lay down in the chair. Lay down in the chair. Finally, he lays down in the chair. And it's like he's messing with the with the psychologist. You know, he's messing with
that's
her.
That's what he thinks. That's what he thinks. Yeah. And see, this is the thing, is that, you know, Kate Blanchett's character, Dr. Ritter, she's playing him. Right. So he thinks he's one up on her, and she realizes that and decides to play him.
Yeah.
Right. And so she plays him, makes him think that he's on top of her and that he's the one in control. And then she manipulates him to go rip off Ezra. Right. And he keeps all the money in her safe.
Yes. Yes.
And then Dr. Ritter, Kate Blanchett, finally reveals that no, she's been playing him. She has all the money, and she's like, "You're on your own, buddy." That's when
these actors are so great too. I mean, we were talking about Kate Blanchett earlier, but Bradley Cooper, I mean, he is so commanding in this. He draws you in. There was a movie out called Licorice Pizza about 2 months ago, I think. And I went and saw it, and he's in that. And he's so good in that, too. He's hilarious in that. So funny. He plays Barbara Streisand's husband. And he's just a philanderer. And it's just, I mean, I don't know if have you seen that movie?
No, and it's funny though, because it's like I'm thinking about it, and it's like, you know, that if I'm not mistaken, that movie is set late 1970s Southern California, and of course Licorice Pizza was the name of the record store, you know, the thing that was all over the, you know, in every mall in Southern California at that time, and then into the mid 80s. And then it's funny because I know later you're going to talk about Repo Man. I'm like, oh, you know,
there's a connection there. There definitely is. Yeah, the malls. You know, everybody knows the malls from the 80s. And gosh, the Mission Viejo Mall was no different. They had was there a place called Music Land? I think there was. I think there was a place in there called Music Land. Sam Goody came later.
Yeah.
What's that?
There was. Didn't they have one of those warehouse record stores?
Tower?
No, in the mall, in the Mission Viejo Mall, they had a warehouse.
Oh,
that was the name of the record chain.
Oh, warehouse. Yeah. That's right.
And they spelled it funny. They spelled it W-H-E-R-E. Like, where is it? Warehouse.
Oh, my gosh. W-H-E-R-E. Wow. I just got chills, man. That was going way back. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. What a great mall that was.
Next to Walden Books.
Walden Books, right. We still have a Barnes & Noble out here in the high desert.
Good.
Yeah. They're good. They're putting all the chairs back in, too. I noticed, like, way before the pandemic, they just got tired of people sitting in chairs, I guess, so they took all the chairs out. But since the pandemic, they put them back. I'm like, yes, I love those chairs.
I hope people go to bookstores and stuff like that.
Yeah, me too. I think physical media like that is you can't really – well, the young people nowadays, people in their 20s and stuff, Generation Y or whatever they call it, you know, they don't really know what it was about to have a book, you know, because they do everything on their phone. So, but you and I do, and we're like kind of the last vestiges of the physical books. Oh, you know what? I forgot to mention your book. Maybe let's just take a break right now and talk a little bit about your book. Tell them about your book.
Oh, well, it's surprisingly timely at this point, but I wrote a sort of political thriller set in Crimea during Russia's 2014 invasion and annexation of Crimea. And it's called Tea in Crimea. And it's about various people who their lives kind of collide into each other's and violently and then but it's also talking about how Russia's and particularly Vladimir Putin's global power plays really upend people's lives, and this is a guy who's been doing it since 1999. And I kind of wrote the book. I had Steinbeck's The Moon Is Down, which was a warning about how Nazi Germany would spread in Europe. And
Wow, I
and
love
uh,
that.
and so I was like, well, I'll try and write The Moon Is Down, but about Putin. And so I wrote it in real time. The first draft of the novel I wrote in real time in 2014 as the Euromaidan and the ouster of Yanukovych happened, and Russia then invaded and annexed Crimea, and left it at this weird stalemate, and so it's kind of really weird and also really predictable that now we're watching, Russia, just destroy
Yeah,
Ukraine.
I
Just
know. It's insane. I remember when in 2014 we were in touch, and I got the book and I read it, and it was a lot of it. It's really weird when you read a friend's book because you're like, oh, okay, this is cool, and you hear him talking and stuff. So I can hear your voice when I read your book.
yeah.
But
Funny, I pitched it around for a real long time to see if I could pick up an agent, but I couldn't. So then I released it in what was it, like probably like 2017, 2018.
okay, yeah.
And but
That was the time we were in touch, yeah.
yeah, and it was just kind of what am I trying to say? It was just kind of
Well, my point was is that it was a little bit remote for me, like, 'cause I'm not all dialed into Ruskies and stuff, you know. So I was like, okay, there's something here, but then all this stuff happened. And I'm like, oh my gosh. He and Crimea, I call it Crimea. Is it Crimea?
Crimea, yeah.
Oh yeah. He and Crimea, like, pretty much got set the standard for this thing, you know? So are you gonna write another one?
Probably not. I mean, I've got a couple manuscripts going, but
Okay.
they don't have anything to do with Ukraine or Crimea. I
There
don't
you go.
know if I could do that again. That was because it's kind of emotionally draining. I mean, we're talking
Oh, I
about,
bet.
It's really frustrating. We're watching literally millions of people have fled the country. Who knows how many thousands have died? Now, as of yesterday, when we're recording this, we're recording this on March 20th. On March 19th, it came out that Russian forces were literally forcibly deporting people, Ukrainians in Mariupol, to far off cities in Russia. Like, why? Why are they kidnapping people and taking them to detention centers in Russia? Deep in, like, these are civilians.
What I see in the news is a little bit of a kind of a culture, like Putin has a culture of getting people to surrender to him. I think that's his philosophy. And so, when you have these bombers coming in and the top of the building of a children's hospital, a maternity hospital, says children, maternity, and they still bomb it anyway. So there's a guy, he wants people on their knees. He wants people to,
No,
rewind. He wants people to rewind to the original Soviet Union. And that's not going to happen. We need electric cars now. I've heard it said that they are, like Russia is like the planetary gas station, like that's their main economy. So he obviously wants to get in there and get his fingers in. Or do I have that right? Or I think that's.
No, fossil fuels are a huge part of Russia's economy, and yeah, I hope the world, you know, boycotts him. I you know, it's, I don't want to see life difficult for the average Russian, but unfortunately they've done nothing. You know, they live in a Putin is a dictator, and we're now seeing it get even worse and worse. At some point there needs to be a palace coup or something. Putin needs to go. And the longer he does this, the worse the sanctions are going to get, and the more crippled Russia's economy is going to be over the long haul. You know, already we know that they're going to lose at least 20% off their GDP in this first year, right? So, and it's probably going to be worse than that. Now, think about that.
Yeah.
And it's entirely avoidable, but that's going to spell, you know, Russia was not an economic powerhouse before. So to lose that much off their GDP is a horrible thing. And then to have this, just get that much worse, the lingering effects of this are going to go on for generations. So, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest thing that can happen is somebody assassinates this guy.
Yeah.
I don't say that lightly. I'm not like some weird psycho.
I said the same thing to my daughter the other day. I you know, but she was telling me that, or no, wait a minute, it wasn't my daughter, one of my students. They said his people have to rise up, take him out.
They do. There's nothing that anybody can do. This is insane. And the oligarchs and the generals in Russia let this situation get way too out of control. And the reason they let it get out of control is that they're getting rich. And so that's why everybody related to Putin needs to feel the pain in a significant way. And it doesn't even matter if they're Russian. I mean, it's just everybody who's benefited from this guy, from having an alliance with this guy, you know, whether it's a Georgian or a Belarusian or whoever, needs to feel the pain in the pocketbook that Putin, Putin the man, becomes isolated, you know. And then
I want to see that happen badly.
I think the world wants to see it happen. And, you know, I'm sorry to say it, right? But, like, think about it. Think, you know, there's that great scene, getting back to movies, Saving Private Ryan, the one character, the kid who's the sniper, who's a really good shot, you know, and he says, you know, put me within, you know, 100 yards of the Fuhrer and pack your bags, buddies, we're going home. And he's right. I mean, everybody knew that. What was the famous assassination on Hitler? There was a few, but there was that real famous one where they tried to blow him up.
Oh, that. Valkyrie?
Yeah.
Yeah, Valkyrie.
Yeah. And
I know. It's well, I guess what the student's point was that, you know, it will just, more of the oligarchs will rise up if you just assassinate him. But I feel like he's had so many years since Gorbachev to show everybody, you know, here I am, this is who I am. So it would take like people below him longer to get, you know, everybody to believe in them. So I think it probably would work, but here we are talking assassinations. But yeah, I would like to see
literally
that.
The most horrible thing you can think of is a man who's waging war on whole cities of people, you know, bombing theaters packed with children, bombing maternity wards. I mean, nothing can get more horrific than that. Right. So
I know
it's like it's both off topic and on topic. But, you know, getting back to the movies. So
sure.
Anyway, my bottom line on Nightmare Alley is that it's a phenomenal, it's a phenomenal movie. It's a really unique movie. Mm-hmm. And I think anybody who's into horror would love to watch it because it's such a neat spin, being a noir movie with these elements of horror to it. I was literally blown away. I thought it was such a good movie.
Me too. I'm glad you brought it up, and I really enjoyed it. Cate Blanchett, to me, she was my favorite in that.
That's true. Yeah.
Toward the end, I was literally she was frightening. You know,
she's great.
Yeah, she's so great. And as far as horror goes, I probably wouldn't have called it a horror, but it is. It's got that Guillermo del Toro, you know, sets and things like that, and so that's what probably pushed in that direction. But there is, you know, a lot to it, and I think it's an amazing film, and I think everybody should see it. But usually, the feedback I get is that when people listen to this show, they've already seen them. So that's kind of how it usually is. But if you haven't seen it, it is not. I'm the one that kind of labeled it noir. It's not really noir. It's more the look of a noir. It has a film noir look to it, but for me, there's another movie we're going to talk about now called Sin City, and Sin City is absolutely textbook noir, because you have everything short of a private eye sitting at his desk, so a dame walks into my building, right? And that's like, you know, that's kind of what noir is to me, is you know, that kind of a narration of what people are thinking. And it's a lot in Sin City. It's a little bit lacking in the other one, but close to it visually.
You've got John Hartigan, who, of course, is the, you know, the aging police detective. And
yes.
and he's got that, narrative voiceover that works so well.
Yes, you're right. It's a lot more pronounced in Sin City. So let me go ahead and present Sin City. Thank you, Dave, for that. And then, you know, you can, when I'm done, you can throw some in too, or as I talk. But this was the one that I kind of, what I do is when I bring people on my show, I ask them to pick a movie, and then I get one that's kind of like it, similar to it in some way. And right away when Dave said Sin City, I was thinking noir. I mean, Nightmare Alley. I was thinking noir. I heard him say noir. I said, oh my gosh, Sin City, that's the best noir I've seen in 10 years. So it is really good noir film, and I really liked it. Let's see here. It is not your typical movie. Like I was saying, it uses the noir function to have people share long paragraphs of dialogue without moving their mouth. You know, they'll be like on a motorcycle, riding a motorcycle, and they'll show the person's face, and you're just hearing all his thoughts as he's driving into town. And it's a different kind of experience that way. I really, really like this movie. It has Bruce Willis in it. He comes in, and again, these are spoilers, probably, but we'll try and keep it subtle. And from beginning to end, you're on a ride with this film. You see the beautiful Brittany Murphy at the beginning. She's in it. And just the acting is really good. The visuals are really good. The guy who directed it, I even have his name here, Frank Miller. Yeah.
Frank Miller's the
amazing
comic book artist.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, he also directed it.
Did he?
Yeah. I'm looking at Internet Movie Database right now. Frank Miller. Oh, also Quentin Tarantino was a special guest director too, and Robert Rodriguez. So you got that thing going on, but then also this Frank Miller aspect. He wrote Frank Miller wrote the graphic novel. That's what it is. But he also directed. He had a hand in directing. So the whole movie looks like a comic book, and it's really cool how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like the Bruce Willis character, how he has like a heart problem, because when you look at cartoon characters, they're indestructible, you know, and he's destructible. He's got a heart problem. So it sort of drew me to him a little bit more. And I wanted to see him win. I wanted to see him succeed. You know, what do you think of this one?
Right. Ultimately he sort of did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. And, The way this film wraps up, I mean, it becomes a kind of a different film like two or three times. But at the very end, when you've got Jessica Alba, who I think is gotta be in her 20s there, really young. And she is like kind of having a flirtatious relationship with Bruce Willis. I had to laugh at that. It's like 40-year difference or something, you know. But anyway, that's Hollywood.
Well, she kind of fell. So, you know, he was the guy who saved her when she was a little kid, and then they framed him up, and then he went away, I forget how he got released or whatever. I can't recall. But then he's back, and he's got to save her all over again.
Yeah.
Isn't that how it works?
Yeah, and it might be his swan song because he's got a bum ticker, as they call it.
Yeah.
So that was, he was like kind of like a superhero in it, sort of, when he came into it. He does that a lot. Well, that's Bruce Willis is often a superhero.
I loved it because, I mean, it's, you know, Frank Miller, the comic book artist, this was his take, this was his, you know, comic book sort of, you know, wild comic books idea of a noir story. And it's certainly, you know, a lot more action than a film noir typically has.
Yes.
And then obviously he's got all these crazy horror elements, like the, you know, Elijah Wood serial killer character. And, I forget who played the politician's son who was so sick. Oh, he was colored
yellow.
Yeah. But you know, he
looks like a Star Wars creature or something.
Yeah. He was awful.
Star Trek. He was awful. And he kept saying how much he stunk, you know.
That's hilarious.
So Sin City is just one to be watched. If you know, it noir films are really fun. This one is probably one of the best that I've seen. Now, if you go back to the, you know, Humphrey Bogart or some of the older black and white style movies, you might get to the purity of noir, but this is just in your face, comic book. Murder, sex, violence, drugs, and I forget what the city is called. Like, you remember what the city's called?
I thought it was Sin City.
I don't think it is. It's something else. Anyway, oh yeah, we'll just call it Sin City. That's fine. but you know, it's not a real place. That's what why I thought that was important to think, because they're just putting together almost an idyllic what they wanted to see. The people who made this, they wanted to see this, so they made it, and they knew exactly what they wanted to see. And it is violent, yes, and it is the costumes are amazing. So yeah, it's just a great film. Definitely it doesn't fall into the horror genre full-fledged, but there are some definite horrific elements and comedic elements. I remember when Benicio del Toro is in the front seat and he says, here's this gun, be careful, it's got a kick. And the gun actually goes into his brain. And the gun's sticking out as he's sitting in the car and a cop pulls him over. It's just so, I mean, like, what would a cop say if they saw that? You know what I mean?
Well, and then of course, he kind of becomes a ghost or whatever. And he's, who is as the, you know, Benicio del Toro's like, you know, ghost, which is who's he harassing? Is it Hartigan or is it the other guy?
He's hearing him talk, but we don't know if it's Clive Owen.
Yeah. Okay. All right. It's Clive Owen. Yeah.
Yeah. His character.
He's constantly harassing him. I thought that was great.
It was. It reminded me a little bit of American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, don't call me Meatloaf. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't call me Meatloaf. That's hilarious.
Yeah. No, it was the same shtick. Oh, it was terrific. And No, I thought it had a lot of crazy. That's what I love about it. The movie's so nutty. It's got like these. It's got like these weird horror elements to it. It's got these weird sort of like 1980s escapist sci-fi, like think about it. They've got the one, like Basin City, that's the name of the city. Basin,
there you go, that's what I was looking for. Yeah.
Basin City is like, it's clearly the comic book idea of a noir city, right? And everything, all the extremity of it is like dialed up to 11, and so Yeah, and so like they even have like the one part of the red light district is controlled by the hookers, and if you you know, and if you the cops come in there without a pass, they you know they'll get killed, and it's like it's like straight out of like Escape from New York or Warriors. You know, there's nothing that like that's you're never gonna see something like that in like a 1930s or 40s film noir.
Yeah, and you know, when somebody gets shot, like milky white glows in the street. Yeah. You know, like that gives you a black and white. Black and
white, yeah. Yeah, awesome. Yeah, it's totally over the top, and so it's I don't know, it's such a neat movie. It's got these.
It is.
It's got these crazy elements of like 80s action flicks to it and film noir. And obviously, you know, the real baseline is, you know, film noir detective story. But then it's got like, you know, all the horror elements and everything else.
Yeah.
They're really neat. It's a real, I'd love to go back and read the comic book. I've never read it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they glean a lot from graphic novels.
I never read Frank Miller's 300 either, which of course was made into a movie.
I loved 300.
Yeah.
That was an amazing movie. Well, very good. So Nightmare Alley has little in common with Sin City, mostly being a noir horror film.
Yeah.
But as we go out here, let's just take a look at two films. If you think of another one, we can do a third, but let's just look at Repo Man and Dune. You want to take Dune, right?
Yeah, I'll take Dune. So I finally watched Dune, and it's weird. So I had really wanted to see it when they were talking about coming out because I really like Villeneuve as a director, and I think he's just phenomenal. And of course, you know, I think it's gotten a nomination for. Best Picture, but so I was really excited. I'm a huge fan of the Dune novels. I've read them all, I watched the Lynch movie when it came out. I remember seeing it at the El Toro 5, and that was and that was when I, you know, unless you were there, you'll never recall this. But if you saw Dune in the theaters, they literally gave people photocopied glossaries of terms used in the movie.
No.
So yeah, totally. Yeah. They give you a glossary.
Cool.
I wish I'd hung on to that. But anyway, so saw the David Lynch movie, and then of course the sci-fi series. I remember the Sci-Fi Channel did a mini series of Dune. That's really underrated. And then
really? I'll check that out.
Yeah, and then this movie, and Villeneuve's movie, and I was totally pumped for this. You know, it looked like it was going to be a real visual treat, and you know, and Villeneuve did such a great job with Blade Runner 2049. I can't underscore.
I loved that. I saw that. I loved it.
He did such a good job. He totally picked off, or he totally picked up the whole. He really picked up with the whole Gibson ideal of using science fiction as a vehicle to discuss, you know, different types of discussions about ontology, right? You know, that's William Gibson was really trying to use science fiction to talk about philosophy. And the nature of being, and the nature of self, and the nature of of existence, and
that's what everybody talks about nowadays in psychology. So it's so funny how it's come full circle, or maybe he was before his time. I don't know, but
He was a smart dude, and an Orange County author, I might add. And
I did not know that.
Oh yeah, totally. And yeah, he lived in Santa Ana.
Unreal.
And then he went kind of crazy towards the end. But he did such a good job with Blade Runner 2049. It was so respectful of the source material, and it was terrific. And so I was pumped for this. And I got to tell you, I was completely disappointed. Yeah, I was so excited to see this movie. I finally got to see it on HBO Max. I really wanted to have seen it in the theater for the full impact. But you want to know what? Everybody disses the David Lynch movie from the 1980s. You want to know what? David Lynch did a way better job. And what I mean by that is the David Lynch film. One thing about Dune that a lot of people don't know, if you've read the novel, or if you haven't read the novel, is
that I have to confess, I have not read the novel, but it was on everybody's desk in high school, wasn't it? I mean, it was. I heard so much about it, and I watched the original movie, so I do have some familiarity with it.
Well,
I did watch this new one too, and I'm surprised you didn't like it because I got the impression that you really liked it, but you never really told me that.
Well, let me. Here's the deal: Lynch wasn't the best movie either, but one of the real problems. Okay, so if you just compare the scenes that both movies had, Lynch did a much, much better job. Like, for instance, there's the scene where Paul gets tested by the Reverend Mother Gaius Mohaim, right? In the Dune movie, that scene is electric with tension. You know, put your hand in the box, right? And that scene is like crazy. The tension in it is nuts. The dialogue is intense, and you really feel like Paul is going through an incredible trial. So's the Reverend Mother. Death looms because, you know, she can stick him in the neck with her poison needle any second that he removes his hand from the box, and you know she will. And and outside the door, Lady Jessica is waiting to find out if her son dies or not. And that scene is so tense. In the new movie, there's no tension. Seriously, Damien, it almost feels glossed over.
When the mother puts the needle behind his head, she's like consoling him. He's really nervous. He is tense at that point. He's afraid of what she's going to do with that needle.
If you notice, he never all the cool dialogue has been removed from that scene. And it's really important. The dialogue, all the memorable lines from the 1984 movie are lifted directly from the novel. Frank Herbert, two things that people don't get about that novel or if you've only seen the films, is that one, he has these scenes, like he has whole chapters where just two people are talking, and those scenes are electric. It's like reading Shakespeare. The dialogue is so well done, it reveals so much without being expository at all. The other thing that people don't realize is that in the books, there's this whole, at least the first third of the book, maybe the first half, is all about political intrigue that builds up to House Atreides getting screwed on this planet Dune. And so there's all this intrigue that happens that neither movie did really well. But if I had to pick one of the two, I would say that the Lynch movie at least tried to do a better job of showing that intrigue. The new movie didn't do any of it. It didn't show anything. And really the only effort to tell that part of the story was the Sci-Fi series. The Sci-Fi Channel series of Dune did a terrific job of playing up all that courtly intrigue and all the stuff that happens to isolate and then destroy House Atreides on Dune. And so it's the neatest part of the book is all this intrigue, and the only effort to have gotten it right has been this TV series that nobody watched. Right?
Well, at least there's something out there.
Yeah, yeah. But the interesting thing about the Villeneuve movie is that I gotta say it's obvious that Villeneuve wants to make a war movie. Because you don't even really feel this, like, you know, the main character Paul, it's clear that he's the Kwisatz Haderach, he's the, you know, the sci-fi messiah in this story, and you don't even really feel that in the new movie. You did in the Dune movie, but I'm hoping that in the part two that Villeneuve makes, that he at least plays that up. That you know, Paul is this uber powerful, amazing. I think that in 2.5 hours, 3 hours, Lynch did far more than Villeneuve did. And the Lynch, the stuff that Lynch has going against it is those stupid weirding modules.
Yeah.
But the flip side is that, you know, you gotta, it's the 1980s.
Right.
They couldn't film like mass martial arts scenes, you know.
Oh, the, yeah.
You know, so they had to come up, because in the book, that's the thing about the books, is that the weirding way is this, like, it's like this martial arts you know, you couldn't, there was no way they were going to be able to film that kind of stuff in the 1980s. So they come up with this dumb weirding module thing that was really stupid. And I think that was a huge turnoff. And it is dumb. It is dumb. But I think that Lynch executed against the source material. I think Lynch executed better than Villeneuve in terms of telling a story, and which is the ultimate goal.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. I think it'd be neat on the podcast to have like a film versus book, because it'd be neat to know the movies that are out there that have succeeded.
Yeah.
The chasm.
Yeah. I mean, the first one you should do is The Shining.
Oh yeah. 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 My friend Lawrence and I were working on that. And then we've probably taken on too much, but we're going to do Dr. Sleep also.
Ooh.
Because we both saw the Dr. Sleep movie and we were like not into it, but it's probably because we're measuring it against the Kubrick's Shining, you know. Mm-hmm. And I you probably know the story. Stephen King hates that movie. He said that they did it wrong. So I've been doing the audiobook. I think I might read it too, or just instead of audiobook, because it just takes so many hours to. But I would like to know like what the original Shining was, because listening to it a little bit, I got the idea that it's not like what we saw with Jack Nicholson. It's more like this dad, like more of a dad guy that's going up to write his book, you know, and the whole Red Rum thing is completely different in the book than it is in the movie. So yeah, I think that might be an interesting direction. You should come back sometime and. If you have the time to read a whole book.
but the funny thing is, don't forget that Stephen King like hates, I think, all the movies that have been made
Probably.
From books. But the flip side is that the one that Stephen King directed or whatever was freaking terrible.
Yeah.
So it's like Stephen King can kind of shut up a little bit and maybe.
Yeah, really.
I mean, because with Villeneuve, like, I can see what he's trying to do, and he's trying to make a movie, not trying to make the book. But the problem is that the book is such a good story that to not try and stay rooted to the source material works against him. And I mean, ultimately, I watched a movie that didn't have a story. There was some story, but like, I don't know how somebody who isn't familiar with either the Dune book or the David Lynch movie could have watched Dune on its own, this 20, you know, Villeneuve's Dune, and been happy with it.
My next door neighbor, he's really into like Vikings. He like has Viking stuff all in his house, and I mentioned it to him the other day. I said, did you happen to see Dune? He's like, I never really got into that. It was kind of complicated. That's what he, those are the exact words. So I think it just takes a certain knowledge. You have to have a lot of knowledge about Dune to really enjoy Dune.
Well, you know what's a trip is I never read the books or anything when the David Lynch movie. I watched the David Lynch movie Cold, and I was totally blown away. I got the story easily, and that's what inspired me to start reading the novels. Was the
That's backwards.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So very neat stuff. All right. Well, let me just look at this other movie we call Repo Man.
Yeah, going back to high school.
I know it. Jeez, Emilio Estevez. He did things before he was the Mighty Ducks guy. But
great in that.
He is, and he's so young. Repo Man.
He was about our age when that movie got.
Yeah, he's probably older than us at that. I mean, I don't know. You're about a year older than me, I think. So I don't know what he is, but yeah, he just, because I've always like thought of him as sort of like this Disney character in Mighty Duck or The Breakfast Club. He's in The Breakfast Club too. That was amazing. He's the wrestler in that, you know. Kind of reminded me of Kevin Bedrisco. Yeah. You remember Kevin Bedrisco?
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so this movie's great. I mean, I just recommend it for fun. It's highly goofy. People spontaneously combust, which is super funny. I remember people were talking about that a lot when that came out. It was like this like huge fear. Like, boy, things have changed. Like now it's a pandemic, but back then it was like everyone was afraid they're going to spontaneously combust, you know. But you remember those scenes where those shoes will be smoking and stuff?
Say that again.
Like there's scenes where people spontaneously combust. You remember those scenes?
Well, and there's when they open up the trunk, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, I mean, it is so good. You almost have to know L.A. a little bit to really get how cool it is. Because you see L.A. back then. It's just changed. It hasn't changed that much, but it's, I don't know, there's a feeling to it when you watch this movie like you're being transported back to the 80s.
Oh, totally.
But yeah, I really like this movie. It was super fun, and I think the reason I wanted to see it was, honestly, I've lost track. I've been watching so many movies lately, but for this one, it just brought back high school. It brought back LA. It brought back so many things, and I really, really liked it. Now, Dave, you recommended it to me, so you want to tell us some humdingers about it?
Well, I just I'm kind of that was one that we used to regularly rent from Federated.
I know. I can't believe I forgot. When I watched it, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this. You know.
Yeah. So you did, because you had said, oh, I don't think I ever watched it. I'm like, really? Because we used to watch that like repeatedly. I think no, you're right. The movie is it's a time capsule for our high school years. You know, it is, I mean, I don't even know how to explain it. Like like outside of all the crazy stuff, right? Like, the government experiment and all the agents chasing after people,
yes,
and that crazy stuff. But just the regular stuff, like the Blue Label food, like people don't know that's a real thing. Like Ralph's had blue, that was their generic brand. And so like you would buy like, you know, rice cereal, and it wouldn't be Rice Krispies. It would be rice cereal, and it would be in a white box with a blue stripe. And then there would be black lettering that said, you know, puffed rice cereal or whatever. And like that was their, generic brand, and it was cheaper. And so like you saw that stuff everywhere. I used to drink. I remember as a joke, we used to drink the Ralph's Blue Label beer, and it sucked, but it was cheap.
It was terrible.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. But it was like Lucky Lager or Meister Brauer or any of that other dirt cheap beer. That's why you bought it. And What am I trying to say? It was it like you had the parents who were totally the ex hippie parents who were totally checked out, who were zoned in front of the TV, giving all their money to like TV preachers. Like that's a real thing. People were really doing that in the 1980s in L.A. You had the Reverend Gene Scott and doing his ministries out of L.A. and he would rip people off. You had the Praise the Lord Club down by us in Orange County, and yes. People would give their money to the PTL Club, to Patty and Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. I mean, it just all these vile. You know, people ripping off families. You had all those weird ideas about like spontaneous combustion, and all those conspiracy theories, the satanic panic where heavy metal music and Dungeons and Dragons were satanic, and all that other stuff. It was just too ridiculous, and the movie captures it perfectly. And so why wouldn't any kid be a disaffected punk? And like they were. I mean, our high school was full of punks. Oh, yeah. You know, and you and I were into the Scooters. And I love the scene where the Untouchables, who have a cameo part in the movie, the Untouchables, the sort of revival, ska revival band that was real popular. And you want to know what they just recently played? They're still around. Jerry played. Yeah. They chase after Emilio Estevez on their scooters or no, they all ride home to their mom's house while Emilio Estevez is trying to repo her car, and then they beat the crap out of him.
That's right. Yeah. And a special mention for Harry Dean Stanton.
Oh, he's great.
I like him in this a lot.
Oh, he's so good.
Yeah, when he steps out of the car and he says, "I gotta do this," you know, and come and get me, copper. You know, and they just, well, this is just a spoiler everywhere, so beware.
It's such a great time capsule. It's like, and it really was like we, you know, kids our age, we would go up to L.A. to see shows or go to Long Beach to see shows. I used to go to Long Beach all the time, or the Roxy, or, you know, wherever to go see bands.
Galaxy Theater.
All that stuff. Yeah. And what was the one that was across the parking lot from Capitol Records? Not the Palladium, the Palace.
And, the Palace. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Palladium's cool, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Alarm there.
There were so many cool clubs, or the they had the Cavern on Hollywood Boulevard. That was real popular. You see mod shows there, and then not too far away off of Vine was Gino's, which I used to go to regularly. That was like a dance club for it was like a soul dance club for all the mod kids. And,
oh, how fun! You used to go out there.
Oh, totally. Yeah. All the time. That's so cool. And we'd wrap up with, Sunday afternoons, they would spin soul records at Goody's in Fullerton.
Oh,
and so it's like you would go up and you would start Friday night. You wouldn't finish until Sunday afternoon. So Emilio Estevez's character, it was great. You know, it's just kind of this disaffected. I mean, I think that's how most kids felt, was like, this is bullshit. Everything is about this is bullshit. And he finally finds some direction in getting a job as a repo man, and then everything goes apewire.
Yeah, there was, just to rewind for a second, there was a movie about, I had repo in the title, I think. And it was about organ stealing people's organs.
Oh, crazy.
So that's what I thought that was. But it clearly was not. It's a super fun punk style 80s film. And I loved it. So thank you for directing me that way. That's a good film. So looking at it all, I think we covered it. And do you have any final words about anything we've talked about? Or we could just maybe do a final word on our movie here, what we've been watching.
The first two movies, I'd say go see them. Repo Man, you should see that once a month. That's still one of my favorite movies.
And, I love that. It's sort of a Mad Max feel, isn't it? I mean, of course, it's in L.A., not Australia, but it reminds me of Mad Max in a way. A lot of it, just the time it was.
It's just great. I just like him trying to, you know, find a job or whatever. You know? It's just,
yeah, I know. You know? And that's how it was when you got out of high school. It's like, what do we do now?
Yeah, no, it was great. Dune. I don't know. Dune's a weird one because I think people need to give Lynch's movie a second look because I think that ultimately he told away. I think because the only reason I bring it up is that I think David Lynch got unfairly bashed for that movie. You know, everybody talked about what an abortion it is, and I'm like, no, it's not. Look, I'm no fanboy, right? Like, there's some Lynch movies I think are terrific, and some David Lynch movies I think are so-so. But I just think that he got unfairly panned. And are there some dumb aspects to his version of Dune? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, I think that he did a better job than Villeneuve, who's kind of a critical darling, and I'm kind of like, I don't even get how Villeneuve's movie is being nominated for a Best Picture. I don't know.
It is? I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Visually, it is amazing, and he's got...
You know, visually, it's great, and it's got a great cast.
Yeah.
And he's good at setting tone and mood. He's a great director, but I just... At the end of the day, like I said, I think you got to tell a story, and I don't think Dune 2021 tells a story as much as Dune 1984.
You need somebody to jump, a director to jump in there and say, I'm going to make this unlike any sci-fi. I'm going to make it unlike Star Wars. I'm going to make it unlike this or that or Star Trek or whatever.
Well, you know, there was one director who wanted to do that.
Yeah?
Alejandro Jodorowsky. Who did, you know, the surrealist filmmaker from Chile who did Holy Mountain and but if you haven't seen the movie Jodorowsky's Dune, make sure to watch that documentary and you'll realize that basically Jodorowsky and Jean Giraud, aka Mobius, and some other folks are basically responsible for all the popular cinema that you've seen starting from about 1979. They never were able to make their version of Dune.
Yeah.
Never were.
Yeah, I watched part of that. That's a really good show. They explain it really well. That you said too to me about how the way it's written, it's not written in like prose format. It's more memory and some of the alternative ways of getting a point across. So that makes it hard to write a script for it. You know?
Well, and it's so huge, and Herbert's talking about so many different things. Mm-hmm. And Jodorowsky, when he was making the movie, he said, "I'm trying to make the film equivalent of LSD." And that's what he wanted the experience to be like. Wow. and for filmgoers, and it got, but you had Dan Bannon and all these other people involved in it who went on to make, and you had Giger in it and other people, and they all went on to make Alien, Blade Runner, so on and so forth. And all those movies begat even more. And all the look and feel and tone and subject matter of the movies that really shaped all the big experience movies that we have come to enjoy and career and helped influence the careers of filmmakers like Guillermo del Toro. Dennis Villeneuve and all these other people, it all stems from that one failed project that was spearheaded by Alejandro Jodorowsky. And I'll give you another one real quick. So Jodorowsky did a comic book with Mobius, Jean Giraud, called The Incal, and it ran in heavy metal, and that when we were in
heavy
high
metal.
School. And then became its own book. Okay, so the Incal is like just this cornerstone of modern graphic novel, sci-fi, comic books. Jodorowsky is supposedly working to make a movie of it. And
neat.
Yep. And the person who is going to direct it is right on the tip of my tongue, Jojo Rabbit, Taiki Waititi.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Because
he's not only an actor, he's also a director, right?
Absolutely.
And
I can't remember what he did off the top of my head because it's been a long time, but I should know. I should know. I've heard his name come up a lot. What movie? Do you know what his movie is? Anyway, no big deal.
Yeah, So, he's going to do, so Taika Waititi is going to adapt The Incal as a movie. And he's working with Alejandro Jodorowsky on this project, along with Humanoids, which is, if I'm not mistaken, is sort of the comic book publishing.
Oh, yeah, Humanoids. I read that book. That was a pretty good book.
Humanoids is a French book publisher.
Oh, okay.
So they're like a Marvel or a DC.
Okay. Brand. I was thinking of robotics anyway. It's a different thing. I read a book called Robotics. Yeah.
But and they're the ones who own the Incal, and I think that Humanoids was set up by Jodorowsky and Mobius. But anyway, yeah. So
I hope they bring it to fruition. I want to see that. As a result of talking to you here today.
If you haven't watched, if you haven't read the graphic novel, it's not cheap because it's a big hardbound edition, but okay. Oh man, it's so worth it.
Dune?
Yeah, the Incal. Incal. Incal.
I'll do some research on it, and if it's really coming out, I probably will get that. I like to go in knowing what's happening, you know.
It's such a good story. It's just because we were talking about detectives, it's about a private detective named John DeFool who gets tied up in all this crazy intergalactic craziness.
Amazing. Every time you come on here, you just blow my mind, David. Good job.
It's fun talking.
Yeah, it's really fun talking. Thank you so much. We're probably just going to clap it out. I always like to give, you know, if you're sort of someone that is a creative, and I know you are a creative, I like to give the creatives an opportunity to promote something that they're working on currently.
If you want to read my book, it's available on Amazon. You can get it as Kindle or paper book. Again, that's Tea in Crimea. And you can also learn more about it by just going to tncrimea.com, or you can find it on Amazon. Either way, it's out there. And then the other thing I'm working on right now is I'm making a card game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Catch up with Dave at his socials, too. I'll put him up.
Oh, yeah. David K. Fiction on all the socials.
I noticed he's on Twitter a lot, but also Instagram.
Yeah.
So if you are on those services, add him. Send him a message.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Riley on Film. I'm your host, Damian Riley. You can find out more and subscribe always for free at RileyOnFilm.com. Now, have a great day.